Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. And you know, it is always a wonderful day for me when I get to talk to my dear friend, Abra Behrens, chef, farmer, and author. Last year, to celebrate her book on cooking with fruit, we had her on the show and rounded it out with author Sheila Prakash to talk about fantastic salads. It's an Eat Your Fruits and Veggies show that you will be happy to check out again. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So my kid's absolute favorite food in the entire world is her daddy's roasted broccoli. Cheers! Hooray! Has been for years. Amazing, right? Well, the problem is that her second favorite food is chocolate, her third is french fries, the fourth is candy, the fifth is ice cream, and somewhere down on the line, there are chicken nuggets, nachos, and ramen. It's not that she doesn't like fruits and vegetables. It's just that, you know, the siren songs of sugar, salt, and the fry-o-lator are just a little too catchy to get out of her head. And I also imagine that's the case for a lot of us, kids and adults. And that's a shame nutritionally, but for our enjoyment too. There's nothing like the world of flavors and textures that plants have. And the first thought I have when it comes to eating more vegetables isn't, okay, that's healthy. It's, man, that is gonna be good. So today, we have two fantastic guests who will help make sure that's the case for you too. Coming up later in the show, Sheila Prakash, author of the new book, Salad Seasons, joins us with terrific ideas on making vegetables the star of your next meal. And first, it's my dear friend, Abra Behrens. Abra is a former farmer and currently chef at Grainer Farm in her home state of Michigan, and she's the author of a trilogy of lauded cookbooks. The first is called Roughage. It's really one of the best guides to cooking vegetables I've ever seen. The second was all about grains, called Grist. And her new one is Pulp, a practical guide to cooking with fruit. Hey, Abra, I love seeing you.
Oh my gosh, it's Francis. I'm so happy to talk to you.
I am so happy to talk to you, and I'm so happy to get to read your third book. How do you feel now that you've written like 1,200 pages of book?
Great. Maybe I guess I did have something to say.
Well, I've known for a long time that you wanted to write a fruit cookbook, mm-hmm. but I just kind of assumed it would be mostly a dessert book, a baking book, and this is really not that. Mm. So tell me about that. Like, how much fruit do you use in savory cooking? Because it seems like a whole lot.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this fruit book, I think going on about 10 years, because I remember in 2013, I was doing a dinner up at Bare Knuckle, the farm where I used to farm and cook, and someone kind of in an offhanded comment said, like, huh, there's a lot of fruit in your dishes. And it had never occurred to me that that was A, of note, or B, you know, something that was interesting or out of the usual. And I started thinking about it and realizing, oh, I guess I do cook with fruit and savory components really often. And the only reason I have for it is that I'm from Michigan and we grow a lot of fruit here. I mm-hmm. have always lived, or mostly always lived on the west side of the state, which is our fruit belt. The wind and weather are moderated by the lake. So it's not quite as cold in the winter and not quite as hot in the summer. And we get a nice breeze off the lake. And so that's really good for growing fruit. Mm. So yeah, Michigan is the little plug for Michigan. We're the second most agriculturally diverse state in the nation. And most of that is because of the amount of fruit that we grow.
Love the mitten. That's true. A Michigan reference you for both. People who don't know, because Michigan looks like a mitten. I had to learn that when I got there. So anyway, you know, I love fruit and I can never have enough fruit in the house. But, you know, while I was reading this book, I'm like really thinking about how often I cook with it. And it actually is not very much. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really occur to me to use it in dinner. Although, of course, like, oh, fruit sauces for meat and stuff mm-hmm. are common. So I love that you structure the book by ingredient and then what you can do with these different fruits that you may not have thought of. And actually, we got a voicemail for you about that.
Hi, this is Brita in Brooklyn, New York. And I just wanted to say that I really love your book, Grist. It's sitting on the counter with me in the kitchen right now. And I am wondering, I've long been interested in grilling fruit, but feel a little bit intimidated by it. I know people grill pineapple and peaches, but are there other fruits to grill? And what's your general advice for doing that? Thank you so much.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah, I love grilled fruit, especially because it's just, I mean, what's more evocative of summer than fruit and a grill going? I would say that for grilling fruit in general, what you're looking for is a lot of surface area. So if you try to grill like raspberries, you know, they're pretty small. It's going to be hard. But if you have something that has a little bit more surface area, like peaches or pineapples really wide, I really love grilling melon. And then also, the thing that will make fruit stick to the grill is not actually the sugar, but it can be the moisture. So in general, I will grill things that are a little bit less ripe or slightly drier. So again, like a melon, you can kind of blot the juice off from the cut side. Or if I have three peaches and one is like super underripe, one is perfect and one is overripe, I would go for the underripe one or the perfect one because it will hold together a little bit better. And the fruit itself will soften as it heats. And so you want to kind of go high heat pretty quickly. And you're really just trying to get a good sear on it to caramelize some of that sugar, catch a little bit of that smokiness. And then as opposed to like if you're stewing fruit, you're really changing the texture and kind of softening it as a whole. And I find that for grilling, I'm not usually looking for that textural change so much as the flavor and a little bit of that bitterness.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, because I know in the book, you know, it's divided by ingredients, so apples or apricots, you know, and then within each ingredient, you have a whole bunch of methods you use. And so what cooking methods work for different fruits?
I tend to cook with the ingredient first. So I'll get my like, peaches or my apples or whatever and then taste a little bit. And so if something is really firm and you want to soften it, then that would be a longer cook or a higher heat cook or something like that. If it's the perfect texture and it tastes great and it doesn't need anything else with it really, there's a lot of really simple recipes. Like one of my favorite recipes is peaches just with heavy cream and a cookie sidecar with it because and a little bit of sugar, you know, because the peaches and cream are such a natural combination. And you could do like a custard or there's a lots of like sabayon or other like, you know, kind of sauces like that. But really just like really good heavy cream and peaches is such a delight, a little bit of sugar. And then I always just want a little crunchy cookie on the side.
Like literally just pour some cream on top and put some cookies on the side.
Yeah. You know, and that sounds like a little bit of a cop out, but it doesn't have to be. And I think that when you have great fruit, it's that can be such a satisfying end to a meal. And then if you, you know, you're in charge in your kitchen. And so if the peach is a little less than perfect, you know, you're helping it along. And that's where I think something like coating it in a little bit of sugar and then grilling it or letting it macerate a little bit with that sugar or like I feel this way about apricots a lot. Like I love apricots so much. And they're a very fickle fruit. And so we don't always have them here in Michigan because they tend to bloom really early and then get nipped by frost or some of that. But when we have them, they're great. But sometimes they can feel mealy or sometimes they can feel really tart or too sweet. And so you have to sort of taste them and then decide how you're going to handle them, I guess. And so I think that the book is really intended to give inspiration, but also to teach people how to think about using and transforming these ingredients. There's a recipe in there about pie filling, because if you were to make a pie out of tart cherries or apples, like tart cherries are little juice balls, and then apples tend to be a little bit drier. And so there's sort of two different ways to handle that fruit filling. And this is something I learned at Hoosier Mama Pie Company in Chicago, where I worked for a long time. Paula Haney, the chef there, would soak the apples in a spice and sugar mixture for like 25 minutes. And then you drain it for 25 minutes and cook the liquid down so it would thicken it.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of softens the apples and makes this really concentrated goo. So you're not getting all of that moisture within the pie crust. But then for something,
that's so smart.
It's so smart and it makes so much sense. And I had never thought to do it before working for her. But then something like cherry pie, you know, we're going to thicken it with like a cornstarch. And that's just going to cook the juice of the fruit while it's in the oven. Because if you were to go through that process for apples with cherries, it would change the cherries themselves and it would have a much more like cooked cherry filling. So that's kind of the difference mm-hmm. between juicy fruit and dry fruit. There's so many great
dry fruit is a truly unappealing term, but I know what you mean.
I feel like every time I've talked to you, Francis, something comes up about like, that sounds not good, Abra. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's like a real knack for it. But it always comes out in the end.
Okay, so let's get into some of these recipes. I mean, I was paging through and some that really stood out to me that sound super delicious. And really interesting, because you brought up cherries, I've never heard of this, but brined cherries and salty snacks. Tell us about that one.
I love this recipe so much because I think it is a perfect example of what I'm striving for in food, which is that it's something that we're all very familiar with, cherries. And I was thinking about them like olives kind of, and you know, how to add a little bit of a brininess or a saltiness to them. And so it was like, well, with olives, you often like give them these, you know, salt rinses. And so tried it with the cherries and it just really changed. It's sort of like the difference between fresh lemon and preserved lemon, although not quite as strong as that. Mm. So it has, okay. It takes on this whole savory character. And I've always put cherries and olives together in my mind. Like I remember making a dish one time and thinking it was like a cherry and duck dish and thinking, man, this really needs olives. Okay. But they're not like on paper, they're not a great combination, but they really work well together, I think. And then, so you're taking these kind of salty, briny cherries, putting it with olives and lupini beans, which I got to know while writing Grist. I had never really had them before. And they are a classic kind of aperitivo snack that you'd have in Italy. So combine it with that and some Marcona almonds and then some spices and some citrus rind and olive oil. And it's just something to like snack on while you're having your afternoon Negroni or Aperol spritz or whatever it is. And it's something that feels familiar in that, like, you know, marinated olives and Marcona almonds are familiar to most folks, but that it has kind of these other little twists that feel just like a little kind of like, huh, a little glint in the eye. And that's really why I love that. Plus, it's so fast and you can make the cherries. They can sit in that salt water brine for ages and be pretty stable. You can mix it ahead of time. So if you're having, like in the summertime, at least where we live, people come through sometimes unannounced. And so it's nice just to have something that you can pull together really quick.
Right on. So you take the cherries, you pit them, and you just drop them in salt water. And how long do you let them sit to start to take on that flavor?
You know, as long as you have, they will take it on. I usually let them sit for a couple days, and they don't have to have the pits taken out. You can leave the pits in, and then just, you know, let people know. And they just get, you know, a kind of like a like a pickly, they're not sour like sauerkraut, although it's the same, you know, process for sauerkraut. But because of the water, the solution of it, it's a little bit less intense than that. And so, yeah, a couple days, I've let them sit in the saltwater brine for 4 or 5 months in the back of my fridge.
Oh, wow.
And they've been just fine when they come out. So it does preserve them some, you know, I remember working for a chef one time and I was like, well, how long does it take to pickle the radishes or whatever? And he was like, depends on how long you got. And it was just like any sort of amount of time will bring those flavors through and then they'll only get better as they sit.
That's Abra Behrens, author of Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. We'll be back with more with her in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're all about the produce aisle today, fruits and vegetables and fantastic ways to cook them. Right now, we're talking with Abra Behrens, chef and author of Pulp, a practical guide to cooking with fruit. Let's get back to it with her. Okay, here's another one. Stone fruit and pork is such a classic combination, but I've never seen this before. You have plum cream baked pork shoulder.
Yes. So this is funny because I don't know if you remember, I came over to our friend's Carl's house and I was visiting New York and we decided to cook together. And I was like super hopped up on Marcello Hazan and wanted to make the milk cooked pork shoulder. Mm-hmm. And I was classic. So embarrassed that it came out kind of like curdled, but it was really tasty. So we went with it anyway and just kind of moved on. But I really love that style of thing. But I had spent over the years trying to figure out a way to do it where it wouldn't curdle in that way. Turns out if you use heavy cream instead of whole milk, it doesn't split because it has less protein in it. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of in my mind. And then as I was reading about traditional savory fruit recipes, you know, the French do not tend to cook with fruit in a savory component, at least that was my understanding, except for a recipe called pork avec prune. And it is, you know, slow cooked pork with like brandy and prunes, and it becomes this sort of like glazy thing on it. And so for some reason in my mind, those two went together. Mm-hmm. And then I just really loved it. And especially for the time when plums are in season, because at least for us here in Michigan, you know, plums really hit their stride kind of middle of September. It's later than I always think. And it's right as it starts to get to be cold enough that I want to cook again with an oven and slow cook something. And the recipe for that also has like a potato and turnip mash to catch all that nice sauce after it's cooked. And I just love the turnips have a little bit of that kind of like bitey quality that brassicas have. And it just catches it and it plays against the sweetness of the plums and that little bit of cream and the richness of the pork. I really love that one. We didn't photograph it because it's not a super photogenic recipe.
She's pretty on the inside.
It's so tasty. Yeah. So, you know, put some green salad with it and that'll be nice for your photo of it. But it's so, so good. And it's a nice entertaining one too.
Okay. So you have a dish called Shattering Cheese and Apricot Salad. I mean, I hear shattering and cheese together and I want to know.
Well, I made it up. So I've been really into this stuff called bread cheese, which is a Finnish type of cheese, very similar to like a halloumi or what gets used for saganaki. And this is wrapped in phyllo dough, and then you bake it And so it's like melty, and then the phyllo dough gets super crispy, and then you top it with this fruit and herb salad that has a little bit of bite to it. There's some chili flakes in it that I think pair really well with the apricots. And this is another example of, I think it's actually the same friends that I made that messed up pork shoulder.
We really only have three friends.
Yeah. It's true for me. I don't know about you, but and so when the next time I came over, they were like, "No, don't bother cooking. Let's go out. It's New York City." And so we went to a place called Kiki's in Chinatown. It's a Greek place, and their saganaki was in phyllo dough. And so, okay. And I remember, like, I think this is how so many recipes get written. It's just like a flash in my mind. I was like, that's so smart, so interesting. The texture is so good. And so when I was putting this together, I was like, oh, yeah, this memory from Kiki's pulled out of the back of my mind and then put it together. And I really love it. And I don't tend to work with phyllo dough that much because it's a little bit laborious. But I think the thing that's funny about it is, you know, phyllo dough, you're using the dough and fats to get different type of textures out of doughs. Mm-hmm. That's how they work. And so for phyllo dough, there's no or very little fat in the dough itself. And then you have to brush in between the layers of fat. And that's what gives you the different layers. Otherwise, mm-hmm. if you just put them all together and bake it. Yeah, exactly. It'll just be kind of a lump. And for some reason, melting butter to brush in between the phyllo layers just felt like a bridge too far for me. And so, but I don't know why, of all things. But I started just using olive oil, and it works great. And it's like, I'm so much more likely to do it for some reason. And so, yeah, it doesn't feel like it's an onerous task anymore. So we do a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper in between the phyllo layers, and then wrap the cheese up in it and bake it, and then toss together this apricot salad that, again, just kind of, it cuts through the richness of the cheese and the dough, has a little bit of sweetness that plays against the chili flakes in it, you know, a bunch of fresh herbs to, again, add that kind of tannic quality. And I just love it. And that's another nice appetizer. Or I feel like in the summertime, and even, I mean, I guess all times of year, we do a thing called snacky dinner, where it's just a bunch of those little
snacky dinner.
Yeah. Okay. and so this is, the shattering cheese is great for snacky dinner. And you can have that with, you know, some other like vegetables and a dip, or, you know, the olives and bright cherries, also kind of that. I love tinned fish for this sort of meal, you know, have a little bit of toast and tinned fish and some cheese and a little bit of,
nice
of
sardines
apple
or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I like a snacky dinner. That sounds great.
It's so fun, and it kind of takes the pressure off. Oftentimes we end up having like a big vegetable platter and then a bunch of different other kind of odds and ends, and that are feel really rich, you know, like a richer sauce or something like that. Or there's one in the book that is a baked ricotta with druplets, but the druplets are like blackberries and raspberries. It's the kind of, I didn't want to write a separate chapter for each one of those. And thankfully there was a funny word that could kind of bridge all of them. And so, yeah, that's a perfect snacky dinner because it gets nice and light and fluffy because there's a little bit of egg whipped into the ricotta. You bake it and it, like, the berries kind of melt into it, and a little bit of toast, and that with like a green salad and, you know, a little bit of salami or something would be a really wonderful little appetizer hour that actually becomes dinner.
Nice. And what would you do with just like plain old grapes?
Oh, yeah. True, really great table grapes have so much nuance to them and so much depth of flavor. And so a lot of times we'll just have them raw, and things are great in salads. One of the sweet recipes for that is a lime sorbet with a grape salad and some mint just sprinkled over it, which I really love. Very simple. I also love roasting grapes. Again, grapes kind of, for us, at least in Michigan, come on more towards the end of fall, which I guess is true. I mean, normal crush season in California and Washington State and stuff. And we often have parsnips, or we start to get into some of the root vegetables there. So doing like a pan sauce with grapes over parsnips is really a wonderful combination. And they make good pie too. I made a Concord grape pie exactly once in my life because you have to seed all of those grapes and like peel half of them.
Yeah.
Which was too much for me. But regular table grapes in this like brown butter custard that I
like
got.
Little seedless.
Yeah.
Little seedless ones.
Mm-hmm. From my friend Sandra Hall at Floreal Bakery. It's such a quick and delicious dessert. And I mean, grapes and brown butter just go so well together. The best way to have grapes for some people, me included, is a glass of wine. And I know it's a joke, but it's really true. And that's the other part of this book is that similar to Grist, I wanted to, you know, provide an opportunity for people who work in these industries to tell their stories. And the grape chapter has an interview with Mike and Pete Lang of Mobby Winery up in Suttons Bay, Michigan. And, you know, Mobby has been around for 50 years. They're one of the oldest vintners in Michigan. Mm-hmm. It's focused exclusively on sparkling wines. And there was one year, and I'm friends with Mike and Pete, and there was a year when we had a really early, very cold frost, a heavy frost, and the grapes hadn't been harvested yet. And I had heard that Pete had been up at 3 a.m. building fires in the winery, and the fires don't heat the air, but what it does is it keeps the air currents moving because heat rises, okay, you know, and the cold is trying to settle. And so it just keeps the cold from being able to settle, and so the frost won't settle, and that saved their grape harvest.
That's so smart.
And, you know, when I'm drinking a glass of wine, I'm not really thinking about the agricultural aspect of it. And the thing that is interesting about this, too, is that these are perennials. And so, you know, if Mike and Pete are planting a vineyard now, they're thinking about these grapes in 30 years.
Sure.
Because that's how they have to think. It's the same for cherry growers, any sort of true fruit.
Orchards, yeah.
Sure. Bush, even bushes. I mean, it takes, I don't know the exact amount, but I think it takes about 3 years for brambles to come to true, like, peak production. That's a long time. That's a lot of overhead to take on before you have something you can sell. So it's a fickle part of the food world. And it's interesting to see kind of all of the different ways that that shows up. If it's, you know, climate change, if it's labor policies, and, you know, it's all kind of tied together. And mm-hmm. I think that it's important to not lose sight of the fact that eating is a delight. It's really fun. It's fun. It's convivial. But it is also a lot of really hard work and shows up in lots of different ways.
Yeah. There's so much thoughtfulness and hard work, right, that goes into this fruit and before it comes into your home. So thanks for writing a book to teach us how to be thoughtful about eating it.
Well, thank you for creating a space where we can have these conversations and for including me. It's always a treat to get to talk to you all.
Abra Behrens is the author of the books Roughage and Grist, and her new one is Pulp, a practical guide to cooking with fruit. And she left us with that simple cherry recipe. Find her brine cherries and salty snacks at splendidtable.org. So we're going to go from fruit to vegetables now with Sheila Prakash. Sheila is probably one of the most credentialed people in food. I mean, she's a longtime food editor and cookbook author. She's a graduate of New York University's Nutrition and Food Studies program. She has a master's degree from the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy. She's got a level 3 award in wine from the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. And oh yeah, she's a registered dietitian too. So that is probably the most educational firepower ever marshaled in service of a salad. But she is a hell of a salad maker. Her new book is called Salad Seasons, Vegetable-Forward Dishes All Year. Hey, Sheila, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Francis. I'm thrilled to be back.
It's super nice to have you, and congratulations on the book. And I have to ask you, what inspired you to write a book about salad?
I mean, honestly, there was two things. It was kind of dispelling the myth that salads are kind of a chore to eat. You know, okay. It's this overly virtuous, oh, I had a salad for dinner. And it's always kind of like, oh, you've had
like,
a salad.
Oh, I
for
punished
dinner.
Myself a little bit.
I punished
me.
Myself a yeah. little bit. Yes, please. And so it was partially that, and also partially that, especially coming from somebody like myself who comes from an editorial background where we work on an editorial calendar, a food calendar. And as soon as you know, we see Memorial Day on the horizon, it's salad season. And we know, you know, we're going to start gearing up to promote, you know, bowls of vegetables because that's what people want. You know, of course, it makes sense. Summer is abundant with produce and it's so easy and effortless to make a salad in the summer. But I mean, that's 3 months of the year. There's a lot more to it than just tomatoes and lettuce and cucumbers. And so I also sort of wanted to dispel the, there is a season specifically for salad and it has to be the summer months, and to just give respect to, you know, the winter vegetables, the fall vegetables, the spring vegetables that can also really just be showcased in that way.
Yeah, I love that. So in addition to like the seasonal diversity, the actual, like the number of ingredients or the kinds of ingredients, you know, there's so much diversity in really what you call a salad in the book, right? Some of these salads are cooked. Some of them could, I mean, you could just have called them a pasta. So what is a salad to you? Like, what is the essential nature of saladness that allowed them to be in this book that's called Salad Seasons?
Definitely. Yeah. So I use salad as a very loose term in the book throughout. And to me, a salad is anything that's vegetable first, produce first, because I also have fruit salads in there.
Yeah,
so
mm-hmm.
produce first, where the spotlight really is on said produce. And then you could say, okay, then I guess that could just be like a tray of roasted vegetables. Well, no, not exactly. That is still just a tray of roasted vegetables.
That doesn't count.
That doesn't count. Still delicious, different. To me, to really give it this title of a salad, we need to add different elements in. We need to add probably a vinaigrette or a dressing because that adds layers of flavor. You get acid, maybe some sweetness. And then in addition to that, I think texture has to play a huge role. The difference between a salad and a tray of roasted vegetables is every forkful, you're kind of getting little bits and bobs of different things. Maybe you're getting a little piece of cheese or some nuts or crouton. So to me, if all of those kind of components come together, but still the central idea is vegetable or fruit first, it's a salad.
Right on. And I love this idea you have too of star salads and side salads. So a lot of the recipes, I think like a third of the recipes are star salads and a third are side salads. And then you have a third that are like sweet salads. But what's the difference between a star and a side salad?
So, yeah, I wanted to kind of define things because, yes, salads can play different roles on your table. Side salads to me are pretty self-explanatory. They are, you know, they complement a meal. They complement that beautiful, you know, fillet of salmon that you've roasted for dinner or roast chicken. They're kind of light and easy and versatile, and they blend with a lot of different things on your table. Star salads, you know, they want your attention. They want to be the roast chicken. They're trying really hard to be the roast chicken. In order to kind of make them that, I wanted to add different kind of just like heartier things to it. So yes, still vegetables first, but you know, maybe there's grains in there. Maybe there is some fish or meat or salami even, or prosciutto or beans, cheese, absolutely. To just kind of bulk it up and make you feel satisfied.
Yeah. So I think you even note like the sort of title of the book is a sort of a pun. It's salad seasons, like spring, winter, fall, but seasons also like the importance of seasoning a salad. And I remember when I was a cook in restaurants and I would work the garde manger station, which is like the cold appetizer station, which obviously was where the salads would come from. I remember the chef I worked for was so adamant that the number one thing in making a salad is you season it well with salt and pepper. I remember even gave me like the etymology of salad from like the Latin root. It's sal, salt. It's not greens. It's not a word for greens. It's not a word for vegetables. The word means salt first. So I've always put a little sprinkle of salt on the greens just because it was beat into me. But you have such a wide definition of how to season a salad or what you mean by seasoning a salad. Talk us through that a little bit.
Totally. So yes, number one to me is salt. And so many people don't even think to salt their salads. And so salt and pepper to me were like two things that I really just wanted to ingrain in people. And so I specifically don't call for set amounts of salt and pepper in the recipes. And the reason for that is I want people to just learn inherently that they need to salt their salad. So I constantly am saying, you know, add a pinch here, taste it, keep adding. So add it, add that salt and pepper in the beginning when, you know, you're just putting all the vegetables in the bowl. Add salt and pepper to the dressing. When you combine everything, taste it again. You might need more, add more, just to get people in that habit. Mm-hmm. But beyond salt and pepper, there's so many other elements, like going back to what I was saying about really what is a salad. So there needs to be layers of texture and flavor. And so salt and pepper, it gives you one component of flavor, but there's so many other ways to add flavor beyond that. So things like aromatics, garlic, shallots, those can be in the dressing. Those could be kind of roasted or added to the vegetable component themselves. Mm-hmm. Spices beyond salt and pepper, I think, are really fun to play with. And people don't really think about those
really
much
in salads, right?
Yeah. So like, say, for example, I use a lot of smoked paprika in my salads and my dressings. I think that's a way to add a lot of savoriness.
And yeah, totally.
You don't need very much to get that, which is great. And also can add heat if you're using a hot smoked paprika. Along with heat, red pepper flakes, I feel like those are just a go-to for so many dishes in my life, and they are also in my salads. And then spice blends too. I use a lot of za'atar and the Middle Eastern blend. I love that because it also adds just sort of a savory note, it has some herbaciousness to it, which is really fun. And sumac, which is a component in za'atar, I often just use on its own. It adds really nice brightness, tanginess, which
almost
sometimes
like a lemony kind of flavor.
Exactly, which is nice. Sometimes you don't need more actual liquid. You don't need that addition squeeze of lemon juice, but sumac will give you that brightness without actually adding more liquid. So spices, absolutely. And then fresh herbs, those can be just tossed into your greens. Those add flavor. That's a seasoning, and it's, you know, adds more color to your bowl as well. And then I really want to talk about texture too, because I think texture is part of seasoning too. And so I use a lot of texture through the book. I use nuts and seeds, scallions even to me are both flavor and texture. Things like toasted coconut, even just like some fun things like where I fry herbs to add both crunch and flavor. I have one recipe where I have you kind of make salami chips where you roast thin sliced salami and it creates little chips and you crumble them in. And so you get these
crumbly,
salty little
bites.
Almost
like bacon, like a crispy bacon.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Sheila Prakash is the author of Salad Seasons, vegetable forward dishes all year. We'll be back with more with her in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We've been reveling in fruits and vegetables all hour long, and right now, We're talking about mind-expanding ways to cook vegetables with Sheila Prakash, author of Salad Seasons. Let's get back to it with her. You also have this amazing thing I've never heard of before, Parmesan rind croutons.
Yes.
You actually dice up the rind of Parmesan cheese, which most people throw out, and then people are like, no, 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 you can save it. You can like throw it into a tomato sauce to flavor the tomato sauce, and you fish it out and then throw it out. But you're not throwing anything out.
You're eating it.
you turn them into crunchies. How do you do that?
So yeah, so this is like such a fun way to use Parmesan rinds. So once you kind of get to the end, you have that rind, you dice it into just kind of small little pieces. You put it on a baking sheet that's lined with aluminum foil. Very important. Otherwise, they'll stick and you'll never be able to get them off. Yeah. And then you stick them under the broiler and keep a close eye on them because they can go from perfect to burnt quickly as well. And what will happen is these little rind bits kind of will puff up like balloons and get crunchy on the outside, but kind of just get like soft and warm and cheesy on the inside. And so it's kind of like the best of both worlds. It's your cheese and your croutons in one for a salad topping, which is so fun. They're awesome on soups as well, or even like pasta. I mean, you could use them in multiple ways.
That's so cool. But you'll do even, you know, that little like tattoo that says like Parmesan Reggiano on the rind or whatever. Like, that's fine. Like, you don't worry about that. You just cut right through it.
Fine. You can do it with other cheese rinds as well that have the similar very hard rind. So like Grana Padano. You could do it with a Pecorino. Pecorino would be the only one I'd be a little, just be careful, because I know Pecorino Romano, which is the easiest to find in grocery stores, usually has sort of like a thin, thin layer of like a black,
like a wax, paint, wax paper kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah. And so if you want to use Pecorino, which would be really tasty, I would just scrape off. It's pretty easy to scrape right off and then cut the clean rind.
Okay. And going back to seasoning agents, you know, the key to a Caesar salad really, or the dressing anyway, is anchovy. And we actually got a voicemail from a caller who wanted to ask you this about anchovies.
Okay. Hi. I'm wondering how I can replace the umami of anchovies in a salad. I love all those salty extras, and sometimes my guests just don't. I love capers and pepperoncini and anchovies, not all together, of course, but you get
not
the gist.
Them all together.
So I love seasoned vinegars, and I use those, and I love garlic and fresh herbs. But there's something about anchovies that I think is really special. So this is MJ calling from Geauga County, Ohio, hoping that you'll be able to answer my question.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call. And Sheila, if for whatever reason you happen to be feeding people who don't like anchovies, so you have an anchovy, you know, an anchovy forward kind of thing, what would you do?
Oh, that's hard because I am so much on team anchovy.
Yeah, same.
But, you know, there are definitely ways to add that similar flavor. I mean, it's not similar, but to add that sort of umami-ness. I mean, I think we were just talking about Pecorino Romano cheese, and I find Pecorino to be a very umami-rich cheese, even more so than Parmesan. It kind of just has a little bit more funk. That's the best way to describe it. That I think, if you kind of used that, I think that would be a nice thing that's also approachable to people, because it is, Parmesan to me is approachable. It's just like one step up in terms of exciting flavor. if that makes sense. the other thing I want to say is I actually just was making a vegan Caesar dressing. I was dubious about it because it was like, how is this going to taste like Caesar? I'm running through the ingredient list. I'm like, none of this besides the garlic. I'm not seeing how this is going to turn into something that tastes like a Caesar. And it called for a combination of tahini and Dijon mustard, which I also typically, even though I use those heavily throughout the book, I never actually use them together. And so I was very surprised with how much I got this like savoriness from this combination that it was very reminiscent of a Caesar. So it was garlic, you know, it had the lemon juice, the oil, but no cheese, no anchovies, no capers or anything like that to kind of fool you. But then had a combination of tahini and a little bit of Dijon mustard, and it gave it body, but it also gave this sort of like savoriness to the
dressing.
That's
so cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's super interesting. I would imagine too, like, oh, you can't use anchovies just because you can use fish sauce, but maybe that doesn't actually solve for a problem.
Yeah.
But maybe then like you take another step if you're playing like word association. Well, maybe you can use soy sauce, and like soy sauce will give you the saltiness. And if you have, especially if you have like really nice soy sauce, it gives you that umami as well that the anchovies do. So that could be maybe a little of a replacement in certain applications. I could sort of imagine a Caesar dressing if you just leave out the anchovy and dribble in a little soy sauce. I can see that tasting good for sure.
I could see it being good also just thinking about like, I think a lot of Caesar dressings often call for Worcestershire sauce. And you know, to me, that's like that weird, obviously there's anchovies in it, but like there's a soy sauceness to Worcestershire sauce as well.
Yeah.
So totally. I could see soy sauce working. Yeah.
Totally. Cool. All right. And I want to get to some of the recipes that are actually in your book instead of just helping us like sort of improvise our way into a new salad lifestyle. And one of them that really caught my eye were the carrots with burnt saffron butter, hazelnuts, and labneh. Tell us about it.
Yes. So that has to be, I mean, I love all my recipes. They're, you know, like children, you love them all equally. However, the carrots might be one of my favorite in the book. And just because, it's because I love labneh so much.
Oh, right, yes.
I do love carrots. But labneh, I've had this like strange love affair of labneh since my college days. So I used to work at this little Middle Eastern kind of deli in Washington, D.C., and was exposed to all of these flavors that I never, you know, had come across in my life. And labneh was one of them. And I used to just bring tubs home with me after my shifts. And that would be my, like, you know, cheap girl
so
college
good.
Dinner,
that
labneh.
Super thick,
bread.
Yogurty, cheesy. Of it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's just that the mouthfeel, and it's amazingly rich and decadent. And so I've been so thrilled to see that it's kind of becoming a little bit easier to find, a little bit more mainstream since my college days. And also, I just find carrots a true joy. I think they don't get as much respect as some other vegetables. And I just find, especially when you roast them, that they just become this vegetable that people just are always surprised by. Like if you can really make an incredible carrot dish, there's something about it. I don't know. People are like, oh, wow, they're just carrots, but they're just so much more if you can really like add things to them to make them more than just carrots.
Yeah.
And it's actually pretty easy to do. So this recipe, it's very straightforward, but I wanted to make it luxurious. And so there's this burnt saffron butter, which is basically a brown butter that's infused with saffron. And so you start by making a brown butter with, you know, a pinch of saffron in it. Becomes this beautiful kind of amber brown butter sauce. And then what you do is you pour half of that mixture over a tray of carrots, and you roast the carrots in the oven at a high temperature, and you kind of let them soak in that brown butter.
Oh, cool. Okay, so you're browning the butter already, and then you pour them on the carrots. Do you worry about them burning in the oven?
I do not worry about them. And honestly, okay. I'm all about the burning. Like if there are bits and bobs that get burned, that to me, that's more flavor. But you do that because you want to kind of keep some of that brown butter sauce on the side for later.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so the carrots are roasting, they're getting kind of like crispy edging and soft and tender and beautiful. And then once those come out of the oven, what you'll do is you'll take a nice, beautiful platter, the prettiest one you have, and you'll dollop a bunch of labneh on that platter. And so if you don't have labneh, though, you can actually make labneh with Greek yogurt. And so what you can do is you can strain Greek yogurt, you add a little bit of salt to it just to season it, and you strain it in a cheesecloth for kind of overnight so it gets really, really thick, which mm-hmm. mimics labneh. And so you'll spread the labneh on the platter, and then you'll pile the roasted carrots on and all their juices and everything on it. And then you will drizzle the rest of the saffron brown butter all over the top, and it'll kind of like catch into the little swipes of labneh and just get really saucy and wonderful. And then to finish it off, because I'm all about the texture, I add lots of chopped toasted hazelnuts and then some fresh parsley for just some brightness. And you just bring that to the table like that. That is a main, that is a star, 100% a star. Serve it with some crusty bread or flatbread or pita, because there's so much goodness to just sort of swipe up. And it's just, it really is a way to just give respect to the humble carrot.
I love that. That sounds so good. Let's get to another one too. The white bean avocado salad with radish salsa.
Yes. So this one's fun because it's kind of two salads in one. Salsa is technically kind of a salad.
Thank you for just blowing minds.
Everything is salad.
Yeah.
So this one is fun because it has two elements. So you're making both the salsa and the white bean salad. And it's also really great because it's a bit no waste. So you're using the entire bunch of radishes with the tops. They're totally edible. They're totally delicious. They taste radish adjacent. They should be used. And so to make this, you'll first make the radish salsa. And what you'll do is you'll take the radishes off the big bunch, hold on to the greens, and you'll dice up the radishes, and you'll just toss them with some cilantro, scallions, a little bit of serrano pepper for heat, some lime juice, olive oil, just salt and pepper. Mm-hmm. So then you have your salsa, and then you'll get those greens again, the radish tops. Tear those up and add them to a bowl with some white beans, some garlic, olive oil, toss that all together with some lime juice as well. You have the white bean salad, and then you'll fold in some diced avocado just for extra creaminess and color. So then you have a white bean avocado salad, which is really delicious, but it's missing that crunch. And so the salsa is what's going to give you the crunch. So you'll serve it by just kind of scooping that white bean salad into your individual bowls and then topping it with a big scoop or two of the radish salsa. And so with every forkful, you know, you're kind of latching onto a little bit of the salsa, scooping up some of the white beans, and you get that crunch, the color, a little bit of acidity, the garlicness, and a little bit of everything in each bite.
Yeah, that sounds so good. Well, thank you so much, Sheila. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Francis.
Sheila Prakash is the author of Salad Seasons, Vegetable Forward Dishes All Year. You can find her recipe for that carrots with burnt saffron butter, hazelnuts, and labneh at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. Thank you for listening, and go eat something great today. We'll talk to you next week. ABM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your downloads, and leave us a review. We'd love to hear what you think. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is ABM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.